press this down. Yes, I think we're in business.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Excellent.
So it is May 20
something.
Second, I think, 2014, and I am here at the University Club on the campus to interview Jane Williams, who has worked for the university and for the history department for many years. Jane, what is your position right now?
I do graduate admissions.
Okay.
I do graduate funding that has to do with fellowships and awards, and I do the timetable, or schedule of classes, as it's now called.
Well, we might as well go back and talk about your childhood, are there remembrances or experiences in your childhood that directed you towards a university education and ending up here? Were there teachers? Were there parents?
Parents. It was expected. There was no other option. I and my two brothers would go to the university, and we would go here. That was the plan, that was the expectation. There was never any idea that there was anything else that we needed to do. And it was that kind of, we grew up in a household where my parents didn't direct us to a particular career or anything like that. It was like, okay, this is what you will do, but you'll find your own path. You know, you'll do, I was talking to my brother about this the other day, and it was like, what was it about our parents that kind of, you know, got us to a certain point, and then it was like, okay, it's time for you to take over, and this is your life, it's not my life. And he said, that's just the way they were. It was just like, okay, we're raising you, but then it's your job from this point on to find your own happiness. But a university education is involved with that. Yeah.
So where were you born and raised?
I was born in Battle Creek, Michigan, at Percy Jones General Hospital, the building that the hospital was in is where the Kellogg's, I don't know what it was called, but it was in that Wellville movie.
Yes.
Story, yes, yeah. So that's the building I was born in. My father was stationed there after the war. He'd been there for about 3 years because of war injuries, and then my parents moved about a bit, trying to find a place where he could find a job and then where they actually wanted to live. My father was from Pennsylvania, coal mining family, and my mother was from the La Crosse area, farming family, and they decided to settle on Madison. So I think I was probably a year old when we moved here, and grew up and raised here.
On the east side, west side?
East side.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you went to East High?
No, I went to Central.
Oh, you went to Central.
I went to Central High School. Yes, yes. From 7th grade, I was one of the last classes to graduate. My brother graduated 68, and his class, I think, was the last class to graduate. I graduated in 66, and it was a wonderful, wonderful high school. You know, it was just... all kinds of students, all kinds of kids went there. From the kids from the South Side, you know, the big Italian community, the black community, drew from Shorewood, and it drew from Maple Bluff. So it was, you know, plus there were all of us then in the middle who lived in like the Isthmus area, and it was a great, wonderful learning experience.
Well, it's interesting that kind of diversity, which now is the buzzword and
mm-hmm.
so much effort is put into,
mm-hmm.
was in many ways destroyed by urban renewal,
mm-hmm.
by this these policies of, you know, just closing schools and areas of the city that didn't meet the criteria of some administrator downtown. I mean, it's just, it's amazing.
Right, right. I went to Lincoln Grade School, and that's one that is now the Lincoln Apartments. And most of, I think, those Central City elementary schools are gone. There was Longfellow, which I knew that a lot of the kids I went to high school with had gone to. That's gone. Washington, which is now the education building for the city, that's gone. And Lincoln is gone. So it was like, yeah, my youngest brother always had, he had Lincoln grade school closed just before he finished. Central High closed just before he finished. He went to Lapham, you know, then that changed. So it was like, yeah, he kind of felt he was the impetus for closing schools.
Did your parents go to the UW? Or
my father did for a while, but then he had a growing family that he had to support. My mother graduated from La Crosse, I think it was a normal school at the time, Teachers College, and she didn't start teaching until after my brothers and I were in high school, and then she did sub work, but yeah.
Well, it's an example of how people in Wisconsin from all economic backgrounds, class backgrounds, whatever, ethnic backgrounds, really did have this commitment to the university and expected their children to go there, and were admitted to the university, and the tuition was so low that you really had a large contingent of families that were just either the first person to go to school, or perhaps one of the parents had gone for a while but never completed.
Right, right. Well, when I went, my first semester here, the tuition was $162 a semester.
Oh my God.
So yeah, you know, got a job. My first job on campus paid for my tuition. You know, I worked as a student worker for in rural sociology initially, and that was. It was great fun, but you know, it allowed me to pay easily for my education.
Well, I'm tempted to spend a lot of time talking about Central and Madison in those years, but I think we better get to campus.
Campus, yeah.
And so you arrived on campus.
1966.
Right at when?
Right when things were really heating up. Yeah, yeah. It was very interesting. Was here for the Dow Chemical, you know, was here for the Black student issues and creating Afro-American studies, was here for the TAA issues. And I remember one spring, it was spring, and I think, that, you know, I remember protesting the buses for some reason and shutting down bus lanes. I don't know. It was, yeah, but it was a... an interesting time, and really a very, because it was so political, it made one really look at where your politics lay, you know. And both of my parents were fairly conservative, and I remember my parents being very upset with me for going to demonstrations, and were, you know. My father had said something about what was I doing, you know, this was in protesting the war in Vietnam, and what was I doing, you know, this is a war that the country has gotten us into. And I looked at him and I said, would you really want what happened to you in the war to happen to your sons? And he just shut up, and I shut up and walked out the door to my demonstration. But and then he eventually turned around and really saw that this was not, you know, and he could see my point of view, and he was changing his own point of view, which was very interesting. Yeah, he'd been severely wounded in World War II, and was hospitalized for about 3 years, having and a mortar had exploded like 3 feet away from him, and had massive surgeries, 12 surgeries on one hand in order to make it work, you know, and that sort of thing. So yeah, it was like, oh yeah, that was not particularly fun. I'm not sure that I'd like my boys to go through it.
So you became politicized.
Yes.
On campus. So you arrived here as a freshman in 66, and did you gravitate to a specific major right away? Was there something that you were interested in?
Yes. I was a reader and absolutely loved English literature. Directed myself directly there, became an English major. And it wasn't for any purpose other than I wanted to know how to read, how to really look at something and read it and do critical analysis and that sort of thing. Or at least that's what developed out of it. One of the things, as I said, my parents never directed us to, you know, but their theory of education was not so much, you know, you go to college and get a job, as I think current parents direct their children, but it was more for that broad base, you know, study the sciences if you need to.
Wake yeah. up.
Yes, no. Yes, study literature, study history, although I never took a history course in my entire career. Study philosophy, you know, and that, you know, that I always thought that was very nice, you know, and that sort of that, again, that do what you will, you know, just, to, you know, find a passion and run with it as much as you need to. And if you need it for your personal self, take it, but you don't necessarily need to share it with everybody, you know. So teaching had never been one of those things I was interested in.
As you said, so different than the kind of pressures our students mm-hmm. feel now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we'll get back to the political engagement, but so what was the English department like in 1966? I imagine it was almost all male faculty.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes. I don't remember taking a course from a woman. I didn't graduate as one normally did. I fell in love and took off for San Francisco for a bit, you know, which of course everybody was doing, so hell, you know, why not follow the trail? But yeah, and I think the first woman I'd taken a course with was, and this was after I had my children and my marriage died, and then came back to school to finish, because I only had about 20 credits left to finish, and I think, okay, go deal with that, get that done. And I took a class with Susan Friedman, and now I can't even think of her name. She also taught in women's studies literature, Pondrum, Helen Pondrum?
Sunir.
Oh, yeah, Sarita Pondrum, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, that was in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s when I finally finished. But at that time, no, you know, I remember taking a class from Rideout and Lenihan and some funny guy from Kentucky whose name I can't remember, but I remember we were reading something and he said, and, you know, this, it's funny that this is the only thing you remember about the class, but we were reading about a character named Penelope. And he said, in Kentucky, we don't have the name Penelope, so we insisted on calling the character's name Penelope. So I thought, okay.
So the political engagement, how did that develop? Was it, you know, I mean, if you look at that period, actually most students were not engaged in politics. They were here for, you know, they were in the sciences, they were in other aspects of the university. Not that all of those students weren't engaged,
yeah.
But it does seem that the real impetus came from the humanities,
exactly.
And the social
yeah.
sciences.
And those are the people that I knew. I mean, those are, for the most part, The kids I went to high school with, of course, I stayed friends with during college. Those were the people that I hung out with, and those were the people who were being politicized, or who already were. And then I was just, you know, catching up and catching along, but yeah.
Well, if I recall, it was a time both when students felt empowered, but they also felt they could change the world.
Yeah, very passionately about that, yeah.
They were reckless. They probably didn't know what they were doing, be judgmental, because I was one of them too. But there was this sense of a diversity of political options on the far left.
Mm-hmm.
There were the Stalinists, there were the Maoists, there were the Trotskyists, there were, you know, the Revolutionary
right,
Union.
Right.
There were all the
there was SDS, which I think probably had more members of the Madison Police Department on it than the actual students.
But I recall that there were all of these like political operatives, and they almost behaved like they were in revolutionary Petrograd or something,
right.
Or say, you know, it was.
Let's sign you up for that. Yeah, no.
And they would, you know, strategize. It was really, I don't know if anyone has ever really researched that level of the history.
That would be interesting. I was never one of the, I never signed up for anything. And I think the last group I really officially belonged to was the Girl Scouts. But yeah, it was. I think I was just one of the bodies. Yeah.
Well, so can you tell me some events that stand out?
I particularly remember the Dow Chemical. That was October of 68.
It might even
or 67.
67.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. 67. Yeah. I remember I had been having lunch at the Broad House with a friend, and we were sashaying up the hill, you know, because my classes were all in Bascom, and we were going in. I remember somebody running down the hill saying, "They're beating your brothers in the Commerce Building." So we raced up the hill, and it had pretty much been over by the time we got up there, and just kind of stunned by the whole activity. You know, and there were just a lot of police around. The fellow I was with knew Hanson, the police. Was he campus police?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ernie Hanson, yeah.
Yeah, and made some crack at him, but I don't think he could do anything because he knew his father. You know? it was just really, really strange. I remember also I don't know if it was that event or another one where we were tear gassed. And for some reason, it didn't affect me. So I led a whole group of people into the back door of Bascom to get out of the way. And it was kind of like leading the blind into, you know, but I knew this back door one could get into at Bascom, and we'd done that. And that have since met people who were there as well, but didn't know at the time.
Well, I guess, so you were here from 66 to...
71, I think. I was working at the primate lab.
Oh, when you were a student,
when
you
I was
worked
a student,
there.
I worked
okay.
there, yeah. I worked in the photography lab and worked with a fellow by the name of Bob Dodsworth and... who was the other one? Fred Sponholz. Fred Sponholz first. And we would take pictures of the animals. We would, in putting together publications for the various psychology faculty. It was very interesting.
I assume you knew Harry Harlow?
I knew Harry Harlow. I knew him fairly well. Yeah, he would... come in periodically and sit down with his cigarette, and You know, he'd light his cigarette up, and then he could never quite get the match out. You know, somebody throw it in the ashtray. Anyway, this is when you could smoke everywhere, of course, and we smoked everywhere. And so we're sitting down in our office, which is quite a large office, and we'd have to follow him around and put out his matches, you know, because he'd burn the place down. But he'd come in, you know, and he'd just sit and chat, and then I remember him pulling me out for walks, and we'd go for walks around the building while he talked about me, talked about what I should do with my life and how I should do something practical, and then I should keep, you know, literature and art as a hobby, you know, but I should really find something really practical to do. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll think about it. But yeah, he was a character. He was really, really interesting.
Was Brogdon there in those? You remember somebody named Brogdon?
Brogdon, I don't remember. Okay. I don't remember. Bob Bowman, I remember. A fellow by the name of Sackett. Okay. All doing monkey research. And
did you have any issues with primate research in those years, or what were the photos like? Were they photos of monkeys that were experimented on, or were they
sometimes and there were also we kept a huge catalog of slides and negatives that, you know, somebody would say, I need a picture of this, you know, to go with this article that I'm writing, you know, so we would go dig through and try to find the appropriate photograph for them. I didn't have any real problems with the research because I could see the value in it. Some of it was, you know, a little harsh.
Gruesome.
Yeah, some was gruesome. I remember one morning walking into the building, and our office was in the basement, and they'd just gotten a shipment of feral monkeys in, and they were loose. You know, so you had to kind of very carefully walk and try to, you know, dodge that, sitting up on top of file cabinets and lockers, and you know, it's like they weren't terribly nice, and I really didn't like the monkeys that much.
No, I can imagine that. I mean, when I was a boy, I think like about 8 years old, the monkeys at Vilas Zoo that Harry Harlow kept there in that round
and the round thing, yeah.
The macaws, or not macaws.
No, they were rhesus.
Rhesus, that's right. They all escaped, and they were all over our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I'm taking some of your time.
No.
But they were swinging from the trees outside my bedroom one morning, and I just thought that was the most cool thing. They managed to capture most of them, but then a couple of them were found frozen in the middle of the winter. They found their little bodies. Yeah. Anyway,
and I used to that sort of thing. Yeah, yes. But I used to, every once in a while, Fred would hand me a camera and say, go, you know, go down to the zoo and see if you can get any pictures of Father Love. So we would go down to the round place, you know, and we go inside and we're just like, okay, that's a father. What's he doing? Just shoot some pictures if a baby monkey got close to him. But yeah, it was a fun place to work. It was really nice, and I learned a lot about photography. Did a lot
science in action.
Yes. Did a lot of photography after that, you know, film developing, that sort of thing, so that was kind of fun.
Were they still doing the deprivation experiments in those years?
They were, yeah.
So you would see these photos of the monkeys that...
Yeah. Never took them, but would see them. It was after his surrogate study. Yeah, the most distressing stuff was watching, because they would have surgeries, you know, and watching what we used to call the animal handlers. We used to call them the monkey boys, you know, and the way that they were really, they could really handle the animals, you know, that nobody else really wanted to handle, you know. And we had some cages across the hall from us, and you'd go out and look at them, and, you know, you learned all the animal facial expressions and the fear grimace and all of that, you know, kind of
tease them. Yeah.
That's not very nice, but yeah. I was young.
Well, in many ways, those kind of jobs are an integral part of your education.
Mm-hmm. I always thought.
The jobs I had, really, I learned a lot. So then you went...
went to California.
And you were married and you had your children, so mm-hmm. you were gone for a number of years.
Actually, I think we were in California for about 2 years. And then came back because we'd gotten married and realized that San Francisco wasn't really a place where we wanted to raise our children, that we wanted to have children, and that it wasn't a good place. And we decided to come back, and Will had been a graduate student when I met him at the primate lab, and he did DNA studies in rats with Bob Bowman. And he got a job back at the primate lab briefly, and we sort of settled in Madison again. A lot of people leave Madison, but a lot of people come back. It's like, you know, it's really home.
So when did you come back to work for the university?
Messy divorce, single parent, didn't have my degree, went back and finished my degree. I did it summers and a couple of classes, and I think it took me 2 years, but I was, you know, dealing with the kids and myself and getting through this messy divorce thing. And then I finished, and then I got a job at WPS. Worked there for about 6 months, I think, and it was not where I wanted to stay or be. You know, it was just like a factory kind of thing and processing forms. I got a job at the investment board at the stateside, and I worked there for 3 years. And that was interesting because I started out as a file clerk, and then they sort of said, well, you know, could you back up, the traders, you know, so I would occasionally do some trading over the phone, which was, you know, it was kind of fun when I did my first $1 million trade, and I was like, yeah, they hovered over me while I did it. And then I did my first $5 billion trade, and then I sort of thought, you know, this is not really where I'm at, because I'm, you know. I was kind of like this hippie chick, you know, who really didn't care a lot about money. Dealing with all this money and the fiduciary responsibility that's associated with that. And it was like, you know, that's not really good. Plus, they had gotten a new a new director, and he and I were like oil and vinegar, and we did not get along. And it was like, I better get out of here. So then I found that they had a position at the history department. One of the analysts that I work with at SWIB knew the woman who was the it's not the administrator, but the department secretary, I think they were called at that mm-hmm. time, and knew her and was able to give me a good reference, and I got in. And
so in those years, when you went back to school, there probably was very limited support for single mothers
yes.
with small children
yes.
coming back to
yes.
school.
Yes, yes. I did have the support of my family, which, you know, they took really good care of the kids. They were 6 and 9, I think, when we separated. So, you know, 2 years, They were very good about letting me study. I told them I didn't have time for them to be sick, and they weren't sick. And the minute I had my final exam 1 year, they got sick the next day and were sick for 2 weeks, just making up for it. You know? But yeah, there wasn't that. But I did have family. I did have friends. You know, so that was.
So we're finally at the history department. And
yeah.
What year was that?
1988, October 31st. Halloween.
So what was the department like in 1988?
It was really interesting. I think there were probably 13 to 15 staff members. There were 62 faculty, I think. 62 to 65 anyway. I have not not been a historian, not really read a lot of history. I knew it was out there, you know, but I have come to realize that, you know, the people that the faculty that I worked with are just were just, you know, hugely famous, and I didn't know that. You know, they were just these old guys who walked through the office, and it was interesting. You know, I got to thinking about it, and Petrovich, Mossy, Hammerow, Vansina, who else? Goldberg was not there. I think he might have just passed away before I started, or had
he died in 87.
And yeah, just these really well-known folks who, you know, were would just walk through the office, and again, you'd say, "Who is that?" And they'd say, "That was Ted Hammer." I was like, "Oh, okay, yeah."
So, 13 or 14 staff members.
There were
In those years. In those years, there was a lot more one-on-one work for the faculty. Most of the staff, I assume, were women.
Well, I think we had one. When I started, there was one young man who was there who was, I think he did payroll. No, he did. He worked with the fund.
And most of the faculty of, I think maybe Diane Lindstrom was on the faculty.
Diane Lindstrom, Maureen. And Maureen Mazzawi. And when I started, there were quite a few more than originally. Gerda Lerner was there.
Florencia.
Mm-hmm. Suzanne Desan, Colleen Dunleavy. Jean Boydston, they all started at the same time I did, or very close to that. I'm probably forgetting some people, but yeah, it was kind of booming with women.
There had finally been this kind of commitment to hiring women. But there was still this culture where the staff still, in many ways, acted as private secretaries for the faculty
in terms of
typing.
There was one girl who worked there who was a private secretary. There were two. One who worked with Cutler and one who worked with Al Bogue. And then there was, and then they would do general steno and dictation. And there were a handful of faculty who really took advantage of that. When I came in, it was beginning to be the point where people were not dropping their papers and things to have a typing pool type them, mm-hmm. although there were still some of them. I remember I picked up a typing job there, you know, because I was on a big downtime, and typed Pekka Hämäläinen's Reunification of Germany book. But that was the last thing, the first and last one that I did, and I don't think that was done anymore because people were then, for the most part, doing their own typing. At least the newer folk were. They all had their own computers and that sort of thing. And we were typing on not computers. We were typing on typewriters.
So, tell me about the culture of work in the department, you know, of course there are the gender aspects, mm-hmm. that were much more
1950s formal.
Yes. Interesting.
Yeah, it was, and this was in the 80s, in the late 80s. There was still that formality and the idea that you deferred to the faculty. But I had worked with Harry Harlow when I was a student, and I called him Harry. He called me Jane. You know, I mean, that's the way, you know, that culture worked there, at least partially. And when I started, they were all calling me Jane. They weren't calling me Ms. Williams. And so I felt feminist that I was, if you can call me Jane, I can call you Bob. or if I'm, you know, if I can do that, you know, with some people. You know, certainly couldn't say that to Mr. Mossy, or I couldn't say that to Mr. Hammerow.
Well,
I'm sure I could have, but I was too fresh.
With Mr. Mossy, you could have. Mr. Yes. Hammerow, probably
not. Possibly not, yeah.
Because I knew George, of course. I think he felt, interjecting again here on your talk, he felt that knowing the staff and treating the staff well was essential to functioning in the department, and he understood that. And
he was one of the few. No offense, folks.
He did. He understood that, and he often mentioned that. And of course, he was dear friends with Judy.
Oh yes, yeah.
And
yeah.
They went, you know, out for their birthdays together. And, you know, they socialed.
He always had his winter holiday party. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she was always invited to that. Always had her hair done before she went to it, as I recall. Yeah, they were very close. I told you about the story that he was talking to Judy and I in his office, and he was so excited to have Judy come and see his hooligan lamps. And we had no idea what he was talking about, thinking it was a motion detector, you know, or something like that. Yes. Turns out it was a halogen lamp over his dining room table. It was like, okay.
Good Lord. I know. So I gathered that you would perceive the relationship between the staff and the professors during a good portion of your time in the department as being less than respectful on the part of the faculty of the staff. Has that changed?
It's changed a great deal. Mm-hmm. And I think... really, it changed, particularly when younger faculty were coming in, when the older faculty were retiring, and the younger faculty were coming in, and looked at the staff as not necessarily servants, but as, you know, okay, if I'm not nice to you, I don't get a good, I've got to be generous, I've got to be civil. Thoughtful, mm-hmm. civil, yes. I do remember being sworn at by someone, though, who, when I was taking some admissions files to his office, and he said, you know, he was not very respectful, and, you know, I sort of mentally flipped it. we had a very contentious staff as well. And went through a quality training, which I think pulled the staff together, gave us a sense of what we do for the department. It was kind of a real growth kind of thing within the staff. It was kind of like you don't just sit there, but this is what you actually do. You know, while nobody really knew all of the aspects of what everybody was doing. And I think that it brought the staff together as a group, and it gave us the understanding of what it was that the faculty did, other than just teaching a class, but the writing, the research, and everything else that they did, the speaking, tours and that sort of thing. It also gave us the reality that the department would not function without us. Ergo, we had an important position, and it rose the staff up that way. I think at the same time we were doing that, I think the faculty was noticing the change in the staff.
So what year would that have been?
Oh, goodness. Ken Sachs was chair.
90s.
Yeah, it was 90s.
Really in the 90s, and that would have been when Shalala pushed that initiative, that quality. Well, that's fascinating that well into the 90s, the department functioned on a kind of industrial employee mm-hmm. model mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and didn't recognize the worth or acknowledge the worth of the staff in a way that was effective on the part of the staff.
Right. Okay.
Perception of what they were doing and their relationship, their worth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the staff didn't have a sense of their own worth. Mm. You know, it's not just one, you know.
Yes, one side.
It's one side or the other, but yeah. And I think that really did a lot. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, when the feminist movement started, and you started to see, okay, you know, I'm worth this, you know, I have a valuable place. I'm just not, and it was that sort of feeling that kind of grew out of that. I think I may be projecting on everybody else, but you know, that's my.
It was an offshoot of because. Most of the staff still then, I would assume, were women. Mm-hmm. And then you had people like Gerda, who mm-hmm. in a way was doing the same thing with the faculty and, mm-hmm. in kind of confronting a kind of established mm-hmm. Sense of privilege.
Yeah. You see that, but I think, I think you see that everywhere still.
Was Gerda supportive of? Were the women faculty supportive? Were they aware of any of this?
Well, they were. We worked very closely with both. I think at the time, Jean Boydston and Colleen Dunleavy were associate chair and director of graduate studies. So they were all a part of that that same sort of thing, which you know kind of strengthened the value of it. And we didn't have an administrator, a staff administrator at the time. We were sort of, I like to call it, the inmates were running the asylum, you know, and we were making decisions about, you know, it was that whole quality thing about, you know, the people who have to do the process should own the process, and to determine then, you know, because you're the one who has to do it, to determine the best way to do it. And I think that was...
Well, it sounds like you were very engaged in this process, mm-hmm. and in it's great.
Plus, it makes you feel like you're not just doing a job; you're participating with a group of people to make something you know work better.
So, can you discuss some of the notable faculty members or staff members that you've worked with over the years, and if you'd like to, you know, if there's people that you would like to recall your engagement with and how that differed from other faculty or.
I'm trying to think about, you know, those first people that I met, they were kind of, I was learning my job, so they were kind of these people that kind of walked around and asked things of you, you know, one of the jobs that I did was graduate admissions, so I was I was hauling files to their offices so that they could make choices on who they wanted to admit. At the time when I started, they were still under the caucus system, so I was just kind of processing stuff and you know learning about the whole process of the graduate admissions. I remember. I'm not remembering much anymore. I don't remember those early years as much other than, you know, schlepping files around and trying to learn the whole process and, you know, what had to happen and what was going on. I do remember, having to type the exams for everybody. And that was interesting because, you know, they were asking questions and it's like, I don't have a clue as to what this is. And they would give you these handwritten syllabi and handwritten exams, and Ted Hamrow wrote in a German hand, so it was always kind of difficult with an American eye to try to figure out the German letters, although coming from a German background, I'd seen the letters before, so I had a sense of what was going on. I remember doing Carpot's exams and syllabi and just not having a clue. So I was having to run up and say, all right, I see this word. What is it? And, you know.
You mean they wouldn't even type the things?
Oh, no, they weren't typed, yeah.
They wouldn't take the time to type it, I suppose. Or they didn't know how to type.
Oh, yeah, I think that was, that was a lot. I do remember a story about George and his... He'd gotten a new typewriter and was so excited because it was portable. And, you know, I could sit on the plane and type. But yeah, there were some who just, even today, I'm not sure that they know how to type. So, you know, those were things. I remember Jan van Sina and I have I collect stamps. He has friends in Europe who gets mail from, and he sends... I used to gather together my European stamps that I would get from the mail that I would get for admissions, and I would save them for him, and he would send them to Europe, and then they would send American stamps back, because I collect American stamps, and it's like, yeah. So, you know, we're still trading stamps even today. Yeah, I saw him at the reception, the spring reception, and he said, I have some stamps for you. I'll bring them to you next time I'm in the office. I remember, John Smale, before he got really sick, coming into the office, and I really liked him. They were just, you know, Once they got off the dais, you know, and away from the lectern, and as I had been there, you know, a number of years, they all got to be fairly interesting when mm-hmm. they figured that they could actually speak to me.
mm-hmm. And I know you've become friends with a number of faculty.
Yes, I have.
And they stop and see you and
yeah, Al Sen comes in regularly and sits down, and we have long chats about where he's been recently and how he's doing, and it's nice to feel like people can do that still.
Well, and you are now the longest-serving member of the yes. staff, and as you approach retirement, which is well-deserved, do you have any other... recollections or comments about the department that you'd like to cover? Any controversies?
I don't think I'd better get into the controversies. It's been very interesting, an interesting job. It, you know, I've really enjoyed working with the people. A lot of the faculty are, I just find delightful. I think probably would have found the older faculty from when I first started delightful too, but you know, there was that gap. Some of the staff that I work with, I just adore. Some of the former staff, just happy not to see them again. I have a lot of memories, but I'm saving them for my book.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I think we should let you get back to work.
Oh, yeah, there's that.